And now, the final story in this collection. Palimpsest, narrated by Gideon Emery.
Fresh meat. This will never happen. You will flex your fingers as you stare at the back of the youth you are going to kill, father to the man who will never now become your grandfather. And as you trail him home through the snowy night, you'll pray for your soul, alone in the darkness. Memories are going to come to you unbidden, even though you'll try to focus on the task in hand. His life, that part of it which you arrived kicking and squalling in time to share with him before the end, will pass in front of your eyes. You will remember Gramps in his 60s, his hands a bunch of raisin-wrinkled grape joints, as he holds your pre-teen wrists and shows you how to cast the fly across the water. And you'll remember the shrunken husk of his 70s, standing speechless and numb by Gran's graveside in his too big suit, lying at last alone in the hospice bed, breath coming shallow and fast as he sleeps alone with the cancer. These won't be good memories, but you know the rest of the story too, having heard it endlessly from your parents. Young love and military service in a war as distant as faded sepia photographs from another generation's front. A good job in the factory, and a wife he will quietly adore, who will in due course give him 3 children, from one of whose loins you in turn are drawn. Gramps will have a good long life, and live to see 5 grandchildren, and a myriad of wonders, and this boy-man on the edge of adulthood, who you are compelled to follow as he walks to the recruiting office, holds the seeds of the man you will remember. But it's him or you. Gramps would have had a good life. You must hold on to that. It will make what's coming easier. You will track the youth who will never be your grandfather through the snow-spattered shrubbery and long grass along the side of the railroad tracks, and the wool and vegetable fibre cloth that you wear. Your costume will be entirely authentic, chafes your skin. By that point, you won't have bathed for a week, or shaved using hot water. You are a young thug, a vagrant, and a wholly bad sort. That is what the witnesses will see. The mad-eyed young killer in the sweat-stained suit, with a knife, and his victim so vulnerable with his throat laid open almost to the bone. He'll sprawl as if he is merely sleeping. And there will be outrage and alarm as the cops and concerned citizens turn out to hunt the monster that took young Jerry from his family's arms, and him just barely a man. But they won't find you, because you'll push the button on the pebble-sized box, and stasis control will open up a time gate and welcome you into their proud and lonely ranks. When you wake up in your dorm 200 years objective from now, bathed in stinking fear sweat, with the sheet sucking onto your skin like a death-chilled call, there will be nobody to comfort you, and nobody to hold you. The kindness of your mother's hands and the strength of your father's wrists will be phantoms of memory, ghosts that echo round your bones, wandering homeless through the mausoleum of your memories. They'll have no one to remember their lives but you, and all because you will believe the recruiters when they tell you that to join the organization, you must kill your own grandfather, and that if you do not join the organization, you will die. It's an anti-nepotism measure, they'll tell you, nodding, not unkindly, and a test of your ruthlessness and determination. And besides, we all did it when it was our turn. Welcome to the stasis, Agent Pierce. You're rootless now, an orphan of the time stream, sprung from nowhere on a mission to eternity. And you're going to have a remarkable career. Yellowstone.
You've got to remember, humanity always goes extinct, said Wei, staring disinterestedly at the line of women and children shuffling toward the slave station down by the river. Always. 1,000 years, 100,000, 250,000. Doesn't matter. Sooner or later, humans go extinct. He was speaking Urim, the language the stasis used among themselves. I thought that was why we were here, to try and prevent it, Pierce asked, using the honorific form appropriate for a student questioning his tutor. Although Wei was, in truth, merely a 12th-year trainee himself, the required formality was merely one more reminder of the long road ahead of him. No. Wei raised his spear and thumped its base on the dry, hard-packed mud of the observation mound.
We're going to relocate a few seed groups, several tons of thousands, but the rest are still going to die.
He glanced away from the slaves. Pierce followed his gaze. Along the horizon, the bright red sky darkened to the color of coagulated blood on a slaughterhouse floor. The volcano, 2,000 kilometers farther around the curve of the planet, had been pumping ash and steam into the stratosphere for weeks. Every noon, in the Badlands where once the Mississippi Delta had writhed, the sky wept brackish tears.
You're from before the first extinction epoch, aren't you? The pattern wasn't established back then. That must be why you were sent on this field trip. You need to understand that this always happens, why we do this. You need to know it in your guts, why we take the savages and leave the civilized to die.
Like Wei and the other stasis agents who had silently liquidated the camp guards and stolen their identities 3 nights before, Pierce was disguised as a Benzin warrior. He wore the war paint and beaten aluminum armbands, bore the combat scars. He carried a spear tipped with a shard of synthetic diamond, mined from a deep seam of prehistoric automobile windshields. He even wore a Benzin face. The epicanthic folds and dark skin conferred by the phenotypic patches had given him food for thought, an unfamiliar departure from his white bread origins. Gramps, he shied from the memory, would have died rather than wear this face. Pierce was not yet even a 12-year trainee. He'd been in the service for barely 4 years subjective, but he was ready to be sent out under supervision, and this particular operation called for warm bodies rather than retrocausal subtlety. 50 years ago, the Benzin had swept around the eastern coastline of what was still North America, erupting from their heartland in the central isthmus to extend their tribute empire into the scattered tribal grounds of post-Neolithic nomads known to stasis control only by their code names, the Alabami, the Floridae, and the Americi. The Benzin were intent on conquering the New World, unaware that it had been done at least 17 times already since the start of the current receding. They did not understand the significance of the redness in the western sky, or the shaking of the ground, ascribing it to the anger of their tribal gods. They had no idea that these signs heralded the end of the current interglacial age, or that their extinction would be a side effect of the coming Yellowstone eruption, one of a series that occurred at 600,000-year intervals during the early stages of the lower first anthropogenic epoch. The Benzin didn't take a long view of things, for although their priest kings had a system of writing, most of them lived in the hazily defined ahistorical myth world of the preliterate. Their time was running out all the same. Yellowstone was waking, and even the stasis preferred to work around such brutal geological phenomena rather than through them.
Yes, but why take them?
Pierce nodded toward the silently trudging Alabami women and children, their shoulders stooped beneath the burden of their terror. They'd been walking before the spear points of their captors for days. They were exhausted. The loud ones had already died, along with the lame. The raiders who had slain their men and stolen them away to a life of slavery sat proudly astride their camels, their enemies' scalps dangling from their kotekas like bizarre pubic wigs.
The Benzin may be savages, but these people are losers. They came off worse.
Wei shook his head minutely.
The adults are all female, and mostly pregnant at that. These are the healthy ones, the ones who survived the march. They're gatherers, used to living off the land, and they're all in one convenient spot.
Pierce clenched his teeth, realizing his mistake.
You're going to use them for reseeding? Because there are fewer bodies and they're more primitive, more able to survive in a wilderness? Yes. For a successful reseeding, we need at least 20,000 bodies from as many diverse groups as possible. And even then, we risk a genetic bottleneck. And they need to be able to survive in the total absence of civilization. If we dumped you in the middle of a reseeding, you would probably not last a month. No criticism intended. Neither would I. Those warriors, Wei raised his spear again as if saluting the raiders, require slaves and womenfolk and a hierarchy to function. The tip of your spear was fashioned by a slave in the royal armories, not by a warrior. Your moccasins and the cloth of your pants were made by Benzen slaves. They are halfway to reinventing civilization. Given another 5,000 years subjunctive, their distant descendants might build steam engines and establish ubiquitous recording frameworks, bequeathing their memories to the absolute future. But for a reseeding, they're as useless as we are. But they don't have half a dis... Be still. They're moving. The last of the slaves had been herded between the barbed hedges of the entrance passageway, and the gate guards lifted the heavy barrier back into position. Now the raiders kicked their mounts into motion, beating and poking them around the side of the spiny bamboo fence in a circuit of the guard posts. Wei and Pierce stood impassively as the camel riders spurred down on them. At the last moment, their leader pulled sideways, and his mount snorted and pawed at the ground angrily as he leaned toward Wei.
"Hi!"
he shouted, in the tonal trade tongue of the northern Benzin.
"I don't remember you!"
"I am Hawk. Who in the seventh hell are you?" Wei glared at the rider, but the intruder just laughed raucously and spat over the side of his saddle. It landed on the mud, sufficiently far from Wei to make it unclear whether it was a direct challenge. Pierce tightened his grip on his spear, moving his index finger closer to the trigger discreetly printed on it. High above them, a vulture-like bird circled the zone of confrontation with unnatural precision, its fire control systems locked on.
"I am Took," said the rider after a pause. "I captured these women. In the name of our father, I took them, and in the name of our father, I got them with children to work in the paddies. What have you done for our father today?"
"I stand here," Wei said, lifting the butt of his spear. "I guard our father's flock, while assholes like you are out having fun."
"Hi!"
The rider's face split in a broad, dust-stained grin.
"I see you, too."
He raised his right fist, and for an instant Pierce had an icy vision of his guts unraveling around a barbarian spear. But the camel lifted its head and brayed, as Took nudged it in a surprisingly delicate sidestep away from Wei, away from the hedge of thorns, away from the slave station, and away from the sight of the time gate through which the evacuation team would drive the camp inmates in 2 days' time. The prisoners would be deposited at the start of the next reseeding, but none of the Benzin would live to see that day, 100,000 years objective or more in the future. Perhaps their camels would leave their footprints in the choking, hot rain of ash that would roll across the continent with tomorrow's sunset. Perhaps some of those footprints would fossilize, so that the descendants of the Alabama slaves would uncover them and marvel at their antiquity in the age to come. But immortality, Pierce thought, was a poor substitute for not dying. Paying attention in class. It was a bright and chilly day on the roof of the world. Pierce, his bare head shaved like the rest of the green-robed trainees, sat on a low stool in a courtyard beneath the open sky, waiting for the tutorial to begin. Riding high above the ancient stone causeway and the spiral minarets of the library annex, the moon bared her knife-slashed cheeks at Pierce, as if to remind him of how far he'd come.
"Good afternoon, honorable students."
The training camp nestled in a valley among the lower peaks of the Mediterranean Alps. Looming over the verdant lowlands of the Sahara Basin, in this epoch they rose higher than the stumps of the time-weathered Himalayas.
"Good afternoon, Honorable Scholar Yarrow,"
chanted the dozen students of the sixth-year class. Urim, like Japanese before it, paid considerable attention to the relative status of speaker and audience. Many of the cultures the stasis interacted with were sensitive to matters of gender, caste, and other signifiers of rank, so the designers of Urim had added declensions to reflect these matters. New recruits were expected to practice the formalities diligently, for a mastery of Urim was important to their future, and none of them were native speakers.
I speak to you today of the structure of human history and the ways in which we interact with it. Yarrow, the honorable scholar, was of indeterminate age. Robed in black, her hair a stubble-short golden halo, she could have been anywhere from 30 to 300. Given the epigenetic overhaul the stasis provided for their own, the latter was likelier, but not 3,000. Attrition in the line of duty took its toll over the centuries. Yarrow's gaze, when it fell on Pierce, was clear, her eyes the same blue as the distant horizon. This was the first time she had lectured Pierce's class. Not surprising, for the college had many tutors, and the path to graduation was long enough to tax the most disciplined. She was, he understood, an expert on what was termed the big picture. He hadn't looked her up in the local library annex ahead of time. In his experience, it was generally better to approach these lessons with an open mind. And in any case, students had only patchy access to the records of their seniors.
As a species, we are highly unstable, prone to Malthusian crises and self-destructive wars. This apparent weakness is also our strength. When reduced to a rump of a few thousand illiterate hunter-gatherers, we can spread out and tame a planet in mere centuries and build high civilizations in a handful of millennia. Let me give you some numbers. Over the 2.5 million epochs accessible to us, each of which lasts for 1 million years, we shall have reseeded starter populations nearly 21 million times, with an average extinction period of 69,000 years. Each reseeding event produces an average of 11.6 planet-spanning empires, 32 continental empires, 960-odd languages spoken by more than 1 million people, and a total population of 1.7 trillion individuals. Summed over the entire lifespan of this planet, which has been vastly extended by the cosmological engineering program you see above you every night, there are nearly 20 billion billion of us. We are not merely legion. We rival in our numbers the stars of the observable universe in the current epoch. Our species is legion, and throughout the vast span of our history, ever since the beginning of the first Panopticon Empire, during our first flowering, we have committed to permanent storage a record of everything that has touched us. Everything but those events that have definitively unhappened. Pierce focused on Yarrow's lips. They quirked slightly as she spoke, as if the flavor of her words was bitter, or as if she was suppressing an unbidden humor, intent on maintaining her gravitas before the class. Her mouth was wide and sensual, and her lips curiously pale, as if they were waiting to be warmed by another's touch. Despite his training, Pierce was as easily distracted as any other 20-something male, and try as he might, he found it difficult to focus on her words. He came from an age of hypertext and canned presentations, and found that these archaic linear tutorials challenged his concentration. The outward austerity of her delivery inflamed his imagination, blossoming in a sensuous daydream in which the wry taste of her lips blended with the measured cadences of her speech to burn like fire in his mind. Uncontrolled civilization is a terminal consumptive state, as the victims of the first extinction discovered the hard way. We have left their history intact and untouched, that we might remember our origins and study them as a warning. Some of you in this cohort have been recruited from that era. In other epochs, we work to prevent wild efflorescences of resource-depleting over-industrialization, to suppress competing abhuman intelligences, and to prevent the pointless resource drain of attempts to colonize other star systems. By shepherding this planet's resources and manipulating its star and neighboring planets to maximize its inhabitable duration, we can achieve stasis, a system that supports human life for 1,000 times the life of the unmodified sun, and that remembers the timeline of every human life that ever happened. Yarrow's facts and figures slid past Pierce's attention like warm syrup. He paid little heed to them, focusing instead on her intonation, the little twitches of the muscles in her cheeks as she framed each word, the rise and fall of her chest as she breathed in and out. She was impossibly magnetic, a Puritan sex icon,
ascetic and unaware, attractive but untouchable. It was foolish in the extreme, he knew, but for some combination of tiny interlocking reasons, he found her unaccountably exciting.
All of this would be impossible without our continued ownership of the time gate. You already know the essentials. What you may not be aware of is that it is a unique, easily depleted resource. The time gate allows us to open wormholes, connecting two openings in four-dimensional space-time. But the exclusion principle prevents two such openings from overlapping in time. Tear up and tear down is on the order of 7 milliseconds, a seemingly tiny increment when you compare it to the trillion-year span that falls within our custody. But when you slice a period of interest into 14-millisecond chunks, you run out of time fast. Each such span can only ever be touched by us once, connected to one other place and time of our choosing. Stasis Control thus has access to a theoretical maximum of 5.6 times 10 to the power of 21 slots across the totality of our history. But our legion of humanity comes perilously close, with a total of 2 times 10 to the power of 19 people. Many of the total available slots are reserved for data, relaying the totality of recorded human history to the library. Fully 96% of humanity lives in eras where ubiquitous surveillance or personal life-logging technologies have made the recording of absolute history possible, and we obviously need to archive their lifelines. Only the historical prelude to stasis and periods of complete civilizational collapse and reseeding are not being monitored in exhaustive detail. To make matters worse, in practice there are far fewer slots available for actual traffic, because we are not, as a species, well-equipped for reacting in spans of less than a second. The 7-millisecond latency of a time gate is shorter by an order of magnitude than the usual duration of a gate used for transport. We dare not use gates for iterated computational processes or to open permanent synchronous links between epochs, and while we could in theory use it to enable a single faster-than-light starship, that would be horribly wasteful. So we are limited to blink-and-it's-gone wormholes, connecting time slices of interest. And we must conclude that the slots we allocate to temporal traffic are a scarce resource because...
Yarrow paused and glanced across her audience. Pierce shifted slightly on his stool, a growing tension in his crotch giving his distraction a focus. Her gaze lingered on him a moment too long, as if she sensed his inattention. The slight hint of amusement, imperceptible micro-expressions barely glimpsed at the corners of her mouth, sent a panicky shiver up his spine.
"She's going to ask questions," he realized, as she opened her lips.
"What applications of the time gate are ruled out by the slot latency period, class? Does anyone know? Student Pierce, what do you know?"
She looked at him directly, expectantly. The half-smile nibbled at her cheeks, but her eyes were cool.
I don't...
Pierce flailed for words, dragged back to the embarrassing present from his sensual daydream.
"The latency period?"
"You don't what?"
Honorable Scholar Yarrow raised one perfect eyebrow in feigned disbelief at his fluster.
"But of course, Student Pierce, you don't. That has always been your besetting weakness. You're easily distracted. Too curious for your own good."
Her smile finally broke, icy amusement crinkling around her eyes.
"See me in my office after the tutorial," she said,
then turned her attention back to the rest of the class, leaving him to stew in fearful anticipation.
"I do hope you have been paying more attention."
The rest of Yarrow's lecture slid past Pierce in a delirium of embarrassment, as she spoke of deep time, of salami-sliced vistas of continental drift and reformation, of mega-years devoted to star-lifting, and the frozen, lifeless giga-years during which the Earth had been dislodged from its celestial track, to drift far from the sun, while certain necessary restructuring was carried out.
"She knows me," he realized sickly, watching the pale lips curl around words that meant nothing and everything. "She's met me before."
These things happened in the stasis.
The formal etiquette was deliberate padding to break the soul-shaking impact of such collisions with the consequences of your own future. She must think I'm an idiot. The lecture ended in a flurry of bowing and dismissals. Confused, Pierce found himself standing before the scholar on the roof of the world, beneath the watching moon. She was very beautiful, and he was utterly mortified.
Honorable scholar, I don't know how to explain, I...
Silence. Yarrow touched one index finger to his lips. His nostrils flared at the scent of her, floral and strange.
I told you to see me in my office. Are you coming?
Pierce gaped at her. But honorable scholar, I...
Forgot that, as your tutor, I am authorized to review your library record.
She smiled secretively.
But I didn't need to. You, your future self, told me why you were distracted many years subjective ago. There is a long history between us.
Her humor dispersed like mist before a hot wind.
Will you come with me now, and not make an unhappening of our life together?
But I...
For the first time, he noticed she was using the honorific form of you, in its most intimate and personal case.
What do you mean, our life?
She began to walk toward the steps, leading down to the northern courtyard.
Our life?
He called after her, dawning anger at the way he'd been manipulated, lending his voice an edge.
What do you mean, our life?
She glanced back at him, her expression peculiar, almost wistful.
You'll never know if you don't get over your pride, will you?
Then she looked back at the 200 stone steps that lay before her, inanimate and treacherous, and began to descend the mountainside. Her gait was as steady and dignified as any matron turning her back on young love and false memories. He watched her recede for almost a minute, before his injured dignity gave way and he ran after her, stumbling recklessly from step to stone, desperate to discover his future. Hacking History. Pleasure Empires. They will welcome you as a prince among princes, and they will worship you as a god among gods. They will wipe the sweat from your brow and the dust of the road from your feet, and they will offer to you their sons and daughters and the wine of their vineyards. Their world exists only to please the angels of the celestial court, and we have granted you this leave to dwell among our worshippers, with all the rights and honors of a god-made flesh. They will bring wine unto you, and the fruit of the dream poppy. They will clothe you in silk and gold, and lie naked beneath your feet, and abase themselves before your every whim. They are the people of the pleasure empires, established from time to time by the decree of the lords of stasis to serve their loyal servants, and it is their honor and their duty to obey you, and demonstrate their love for you in any way that you desire, for all their days and lifetimes upon the earth. And you will dwell among them in a palace of alabaster, surrounded by gardens of delight, and you shall want for nothing. Your days of pleasure will number 1,001. Your lovers will number 1,001 as you please. Your pleasures will be without number, and the number of tomorrow's parties shall be beyond measure. You need not leave until the pleasures of flesh and mind pale, and the novelty of infinite luxury becomes a weight on your soul. Then, and only then, you will yearn for the duty which lends meaning to life. Energized, you will return to service with serenity and enthusiasm, and your colleagues will turn aside from their tasks and wonder at your eagerness. For though you may have spent a century in the pleasure empires, your absence from your duty will have lasted barely a heartbeat. You are a loyal servant of the stasis, and you may return to paradise whenever it pleases you, because we want you to be happy in your work. Palimpsest Ambush. Almost 100 kilo-years had passed since the Yellowstone eruption that wiped out the Benzin and the hunter-gatherer tribes of the Gulf Coast. The new reseeding was 12,000 years old. Civilization had taken root again, spreading around the planet with the efflorescent enthusiasm of a parasitic vine. It was currently going through an expansionist-mercantilist phase, scattered city-states and tribute empires gradually coalescing and moving toward a tentative enlightenment. Eventually, they'd rediscover electronics, and with the institution of a ubiquitous surveillance program, finally reconquer the heights of true civilization. Nobody looking at the flourishing cities and the white-sailed trade ships could imagine that the people who built them were destined for anything but glory. Pierce stumbled along a twisty cobbled lane off the Chandler Street in Carnegra, doing his faux-drunken best to look like part of the scenery. Sailors fresh ashore from Ipsolian League boats weren't a rarity here, and it'd certainly explain his lack of fluency in Imagra, the local Creole. It was another training assignment, but with 6 more years subjective of training and a stasis phone implant, Pierce now had some degree of independence. He was trusted to work away from the watchful eyes of his supervisor on assignments deemed safe for a probationer agent. "Proceed to the Red Duck on Margrave Way at the 3rd hour of Causeday. Take your detox first and stay on the small beer. You're there as a level 1 observer and level 0 exit decoy to cover our other agent's departure. There's going to be a fight, and you need to be ready to look after yourself. But remember, you're meant to be a drunken sailor, so you need to look the part until things kick off. Once your target is out of the picture, you're free to leave. If it turns hot, escalate it to me, and I'll untangle things retroactively." It was all straightforward stuff, although normally Pierce wouldn't be assigned to a job in Carnegra, or indeed to any job in this epoch. Training to blend in seamlessly with an alien culture was difficult enough that stasis agents usually worked in their home era, or as close to it as possible, where their local knowledge was most useful. As it was, 2 months of full-time study had given him just enough background to masquerade as a foreign sailor in an archipelagian society that was still 3 centuries away from reinventing the telegraph. "It's a personalized test," he'd realized with a jittery shudder of alertness, as if he'd just downed a mag of mate. Someone up the line in operational analysis would be watching his performance, judging his flexibility. He determined to give it his all. It took him 2 months of hard training in language and cultural studies and local field procedures, all for less than 6 hours on the ground in Carnegra. And the reason he was certain it was a test: Supervisor Hark had changed the subject when he'd asked who he was there to cover for. Margrave Way was a cobblestoned alley, stepped every few meters to allow for the slope of the hillside, lined on either side with the single-story bamboo shopfronts of fishmongers and chandlers. Pierce threaded his wobbly way around servants out shopping for the daily catch, water carriers, fruit and vegetable sellers, and beggars, dodged a rice merchant's train of dwarf dromedaries loaded with sacks, and avoided a pair of black-robed scholars from one of the seminaries that straggled around the flanks of the hill like the thinning hair on the pate of an elderly priest. Banners rippled in the weak onshore breeze. Paper skull lanterns with mirror-polished eyes to repel evil spirits bounced gaudily beneath the eaves as he entered the inn. The Red Duck was painted the colour of its namesake. Pierce hunched beneath the low awning and probed the gloom carefully, finally emerging into the yard out back with his eyes watering. At this hour, the yard was half empty, for the tavern made much of its trade in food. The scent of honeysuckle hung heavy over the decking. The hibiscus bushes at the sides of the yard were riotously red. Pierce staked out a bench near the rear wall with a clear view of the entrance and the latrines, then unobtrusively audited the other patrons, careful to avoid eye contact. Even half empty, the yard held the publican's young sons, shuffling hither and yon to fill cups for the customers. 4 presumably genuine drunken sailors, 3 liveried servants from the seminaries, a couple of gaudily clad women whose burlesque approach to the sailors was blatantly professional, and 3 cloak-shrouded pilgrims from the highlands of what once had been Cascadia, presumably come to visit the shrines and holy baths of the southern lands. At least, to a first approximation. One of the lads was at Pierce's elbow, asking something about service and food.
"Give beer," Pierce managed haltingly. "Good beer, light, 2-coin value."
The tap boy vanished, returned with a stoneware mug full of warm suds that smelled faintly of bananas. Good, good. Pierce fumbled with his change, pawing over it as if unsure. He passed two clipped and blackened coins to the kid, both shredded with passive RF transceivers, beacons to tell his contact that they were not alone. As Pierce raised his mug to his lips in unfeigned happy anticipation, his phone buzzed. It was a disturbing sensation, utterly unnatural, and it had taken him much practice to learn not to jump when it happened. He scanned the beer garden, concealing his mouth with his mug as he did so. A murder of crows, seminary students flocking to the watering hole, was raucously establishing its pecking order in the vestibule. One of the sailors had fallen forward across the table, while his fellow tried to rouse him, and a working girl in a red wrap was walking toward the back wall, humming tunelessly. Bingo, he thought, with a smug flicker of satisfaction. Pierce twitched a stomach muscle, goosing his phone. The other stasis agent would feel a shiver and buzz like an angry yellow jacket, and indeed, as he watched, the woman in red glanced round abruptly. Pierce twitched again as her gaze flickered over him, this time involuntarily, in the grip of something akin to déjà vu. Can't be, he realized an instant later. She wouldn't be on a field up like this. The woman in red turned and sidestepped toward his bench, sub-vocalizing. You're my cover, yes? Let's get out of here right now. It's going bad. Pierce began to stand. Yarrow? He asked. The sailor, who was trying to rouse his friend, started tugging at his shoulder. Yes? Look, what's your exit plan? She sounded edgy. But... He froze, his stomach twisting. She doesn't know me, he realized. Sorry, can you get over the wall if I create a diversion? He sent, his heart hammering. He hadn't seen her in 3 years subjective. She'd blown through his life like a runaway train, then vanished as abruptly as she'd arrived, leaving behind a scrawled note to say she'd been called uptime by control, and a final quick charcoal sketch. I think so, but there are two... The sailor stood up and shouted incoherently at her, just as Pierce's phone buzzed again. Who's that? She asked. Hard contact in 5 seconds. The other agent, whoever he was, sounded urgent. Stay back. The sailor shouted again, and this time Pierce understood it. Murderer! He climbed over the table and drew a long curved knife moving forward. Get behind me. Pierce stepped between Yarrow and the sailor, his thoughts a chaotic mess of, this is stupid, and what did she do? And who else? As he paged Supervisor Hark. Peace, he said in faltering Carnegrin. Am friend? Want drink? Behind the angry sailor, the priest students were standing up, black robes flapping as they spread out, calling to one another. Yarrow retreated behind him. His phone vibrated again, then, improbably, a fourth time. There were too many agents. What's happening? Asked Hark. I think it's a palimpsest, Pierce managed to send. Like an inked parchment, scrubbed clean and reused, a section of history that had been multiply overwritten. He held his hands up, addressed the sailor. You want... thing. Money? The third agent, who'd warned of contact. Drop. Now! Pierce began to fall as something... someone... Yarrow? Grabbed his shoulder and pushed sideways. One of the students let his robe slide open. It slid down from his shoulders, gaping to reveal an iridescent fluidity that followed the rough contours of a human body, flexing and rippling like molten glass. Its upper margin flowed and swelled around its wearer's neck and chin, bulging upward to engulf his head as he stepped out of the black scholar's robe. The sailor held his knife high, point down as he advanced on Pierce. Pierce's focus narrowed as he brought his fall under control, preparing to roll and trigger the telescopic baton in his sleeve. A gunshot, shockingly loud, split the afternoon air. The sailor's head disappeared in a crimson haze, splattering across Pierce's face. The corpse lurched and collapsed like a dropped sack. Somebody, Yarrow, cried out behind him as Pierce pushed back with his left arm, trying to blink the red fog from his vision. The student's robe was taking on a life of its own, contracting and standing up like a malign shadow behind its master, as the human-shaped blob of walking water turned and raised one hand toward the roof. A chorus of screams rose behind it, as one of the other seminarians, who had unwisely reached for the robe, collapsed convulsing.
"Stay down!"
It was the third agent.
"Play dead."
"My knees..."
Pierce managed a sidelong look that took in Yarrow's expression of fear with a shudder of self-recognition.
"I'll decoy," he sent.
Then, a curious clarity of purpose in his mind, he rolled sideways and scrambled toward the interior of the tavern. Several things happened in the next 3 seconds. First, a brilliant turquoise circle 2 meters in diameter flickered open, hovering directly in front of the rear wall of the beer garden. A double handful of enormous purple hornets burst from its surface. Most arrowed toward the students, who had entangled themselves in a panicky crush at the exit. Two turned and darted straight up toward the balcony level. Next, a spark, bright as lightning, leapt between the watery humanoid's upraised hand and the ceiling. Finally, something punched Pierce in the chest, with such breathtaking violence that he found to his shock and surprise that his hands and feet didn't seem to want to work anymore.
"Agent down,"
someone signalled, and it seemed to him that this was something he ought to make sense of, but sense was ebbing fast in a buzz of angry hornets as the pinkness faded to grey, and then everything was quiet for a long time. Internal Affairs.
"Do you know anyone who wants you dead, Scholar Agent?"
The investigator from Internal Affairs leaned over Pierce, his hands clasped together in a manner that reminded Pierce of a hungry mantis. His ears, Pierce couldn't help but notice, were prominent and pink, little radar dishes adorning the sides of a thin face. It had to be an ironic comment, if not an outright insult, his adoption of the likeness of Franz Kafka. Or perhaps the man from Internal Affairs simply didn't want to be recognized. Pierce chuckled weakly. The results were predictable. When the coughing fit subsided and his vision began to clear again, he shook his head.
"A pity."
Kafka rocked backwards slightly, his shoulders hunched. "It would make things easier." Pierce risked a question.
"Does the library have anything?"
Kafka sniffed.
"Of course not. Whoever set the trap knew enough to scrub the palimpsest clean before they embarked on their killing spree."
So it was a palimpsest. Pierce felt vaguely cheated.
"They assassinated themselves first? To remove the evidence from the time sequence?"
"You died 3 times, Scholar Agent, not counting your present state."
He gestured at the dressing covering the cardiac assist leech clamped to the side of Pierce's chest. It pulsed rhythmically, taking the load while the new heart grew to full size between his ribs.
"Agent Yarrow died 2 times, and Agent Major Alizade's report states that he was forced to invoke control majeure to contain the palimpsest's expansion. Someone..."
Kafka leaned toward Pierce again, peering intently at his face with disturbingly dark eyes.
"Went to great lengths to kill you repeatedly."
"Ah." Pierce stared at the ceiling of his hospital room, where plaster cherubs clutching overflowing cornucopiae cavorted with lecherous satyrs.
"I suppose you want to know why?"
"No.
Having read your branch library file, there are any number of whys. What I want to know is why now?"
Kafka smiled, his mouth widening until his alarmingly unhinged head seemed ready to topple from the plinth of his jaw.
"You're still in training, a green shoot. An interesting time to pick on you, don't you think?"
Fear made Pierce tense up.
"If you've read my library record, you must know I'm loyal."
"Peace." Kafka made a placating gesture.
"I know nothing of the kind. The library can't tell me what's inside your head. But you're not under suspicion of trying to assassinate yourself. What I do know is that so far your career has been notably mundane. The library branches are as prone to overwrites as any other palimpsest. But we may be able to make deductions about your attacker by looking for inconsistencies between your memories and the version of your history documented locally."
Pierce lay back, drained. "I'm not under suspicion."
What is to become of me?
He asked. Kafka's smile vanished. Nothing, for now. You may convalesce at your leisure, and sooner or later you will learn whatever it is that was so important to our enemies that they tried to erase you. When you do so, I would be grateful if you would call me. He rose to leave. You will see me again, eventually. Meanwhile, you should bear in mind that you have come to the attention of important persons. Consider yourself lucky, and try to make the best of it.
3 days after Kafka's departure, summoned back, no doubt, to the vasty abyss of deep time in which internal affairs held their council, Pierce had another visitor.
I came to thank you, she said haltingly. You didn't need to do that. To decoy, I mean. I'm very grateful.
It had the sound of a prepared speech, but Pierce didn't mind. She was young and eye-wrenchingly desirable, even in the severe uniform of an agent initiate.
You would have died again, he pointed out. I was your backup. It's bad form to let your primary die, and I owed you.
You owed me? But we haven't met. There's nothing about you in my library file.
Her pupils dilated.
It was an older you, he said mildly. While the stasis held a file on everyone, agents were only permitted to see and annotate those of their own details that lay in their past. After a pause, he admitted,
I was hoping we might meet again sometime. But I...
She hesitated, then stared at him, narrowing her eyes. I'm not in the market. I have a partner. Funny, she didn't tell me that. He closed his eyes for a few seconds. She said we had a history, though. And to tell her when I first met her that her first pet, a cat named Chloe, died when a wild dog took her.
Pierce opened his eyes to stare at the Baroque ceiling again.
I'm sorry I asked, ya, esteemed colleague. Please forgive me. I didn't think you were for sale. My heart is simply in the wrong place.
After a second, he heard a shocked, incongruous giggle.
I gather armor-piercing rounds usually have that effect, he added.
When she was able to speak again, she shook her head.
I am sincere, Scholar Agent. Pierce? Pierced? Oh, dear.
She managed to hold her dignity intact this time, despite a gleam of amusement.
I'm sorry if I don't mean to doubt you, but you must know, if you know me, I have never met you, yes?
That thought has indeed occurred to me.
The leech pulsed warmly against his chest, squirting blood through the aortic shunt. As you can see, right now I am not only heartless, but harmless, insofar as I won't even be able to get out of bed unaided for another 10 days. You need not fear that I'm going to pursue you. I merely thought to introduce myself and let you know, as she did to me, that we could have a history, if you're so inclined, someday. But not right now, obviously.
But obviously not.
She stood up.
This wasn't what I was expecting.
Me neither. He smiled bitterly.
It never is it?
She paused in the doorway.
I'm not saying no, never, Scholar Agent. But not now, obviously. Some other time. We'll worry about that if we meet again, perhaps. History can wait a little longer. Oh, and thank you for saving my life some of the times. 1 out of 3 is good going, especially for a student.
Elite. A Brief Alternate History of the Solar System, Part 1. What has already happened? Slide 1. Our solar system as an embryo. A vast disk of gas and infalling dust surrounds and obscures a newborn star, little more than a thickening knot of rapidly spinning matter that is rapidly sucking more mass down into its ever-steepening gravity well. The sun is glowing red-hot already, with the heat liberated by its gravitational collapse, until... Slide 2. Ignition. The pressure and temperature at the core of the embryo star has risen so high that hydrogen nuclei, floating in a degenerate soup of electrons, are bumping close to one another. A complex reaction ensues, rapidly liberating gamma radiation and neutrinos, and the core begins to heat up.
First, deuterium. Then the ordinary hydrogen nuclei begin to fuse. A flare of nuclear fire lashes through the inner layers of the star. It will take a million years for the gamma-ray pulse to work its way out through the choking, blanketing layers of degenerate hydrogen, but the neutrino pulse heralds the birth cry of a new star. Slide 3. A million years pass as the sun brightens and the rotating cloud of gas and dust begins to partition. Out beyond the dew line, where ice particles can grow, a roiling knot of dirty ice is forming, and like the sun before it, it greedily sucks down dirt and gas and grows. As it ploughs through the cloud, it sprays dust outward. Meanwhile, at the balancing point between the star and the embryonic Jovian gravity well, other knots of dust are forming. Slide 4. A billion years have passed since the sun ignited, and the stellar nursery of gas and dust has been swept clean by a fleet of new-formed planets. There has been some bickering. In the late heavy bombardment triggered by the outward migration of Neptune, entire planetary surfaces were reformed. But now the system has settled into long-term stability. The desert planet Mars is going through the first of its warm, wet interludes. Venus still has traces of water in its hot, but not yet red-hot atmosphere. Earth is a chilly, nitrogen and methane-shrouded enigma, inhabited only by primitive purple bacteria, its vast oceans churned by 100-meter tides, dragged up every 7-hour day by a young moon that completes each orbit in little more than 24 hours. Slide 5. Another 3 billion years have passed. The solar system has completed almost 16 orbits of the galactic core and is now unimaginably distant from the stellar nursery which birthed it. Mars has dried, although occasional volcanic eruptions periodically blanket it in cloud. Venus is even hotter, but something strange is happening to Earth. Luna has drifted farther from its primary, the tides quieting. Meanwhile, the atmosphere has acquired a strange bluish tinge, evident sign of contamination by a toxic haze of oxygen. The great landmass Rodina, which dominated the southern ocean beneath the cap of ice, has broken up, and the shallow seas of the Pan-Thalassic and Pan-African oceans are hosting an astonishing proliferation of multicellular life. Slide 6. 650 million years later, the outlines of Earth's new continents glow by night like a neon diadem against the darkness, shouting consciousness at the sky in a blare of radio wavelength emissions as loud as a star. There have been 5 major epochs dominated by different families of land-based vertebrates in the time between slides 5 and 6. All the Earth's coal and oil deposits were laid down in this time. Different animal families developed flight at least 4 times, and the partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere rose from around 4% to well over 16%. At the very end, a strangely bipedal, tailless omnivore appeared on the plains of Africa, its brain turbocharged on a potent mixture of oxygen and readily available sugars, and erupted into sentience in a geological eye blink. Here's what isn't going to happen. Slide 7. The continents of Earth, no longer lit by the afterglow of intelligence, will drift into strange new configurations. 250 million years after the 6th Great Extinction, the scattered continents will reconverge on a single equatorial supercontinent, Pangaea Ultima, leaving only the conjoined landmass that was Antarctica and Australia adrift in the Southern Ocean. As the sun brightens, so shall the verdant plains of the Earth. Oceanic algal blooms raise the atmospheric oxygen concentration close to 25%, and lightning-triggered wildfires rage across the continental interior. It will be an epoch characterized by rapid plant growth, but few animal life forms can survive on land. In the heady air of aged Earth, even waterlogged flesh will burn. And the sun is still brightening. Slide 8. 750 million years later, the brightening sun will glare down upon cloud-wreathed ancient continents, weathered and corroded to bedrock. Even the plant life has abandoned the land,
for the equatorial daytime temperature is perilously close to the boiling point of water. What life there is retreats to the deep ocean waters, away from the searing ultraviolet light that splits apart the water molecules of the upper atmosphere. But there's no escape. The oceans themselves are slowly acidifying and evaporating as the hydrogen liberated in the ionosphere is blasted into space by the solar wind. A runaway greenhouse effect is well underway, and in another billion years, Earth will resemble parched, hell-hot Venus. Slide 9. 4.2 billion years after the brief cosmic eye-blink of earthly intelligence, the game is up. The dead Earth orbits alone, its moon a separate planet wandering in increasingly unstable ellipses around the sun. Glowing dull red beneath an atmosphere of carbon dioxide baked from its rocks, there will be no sign that this world ever harbored life. The sun it circles, a sullen-faced ruddy ogre, is nearing the end of its hydrogen reserves. Soon it will expand, engulfing the inner planets. But events on a larger scale are going to spare the Earth this fate. For billions of years, the galaxy in which this star orbits has been converging with another large star swarm. The M31 Andromeda Galaxy. Now the spiraling cloud of stars are interpenetrating and falling through each other, and the Sun is in for a bumpy ride as galaxies collide. A binary system of red dwarfs is closing with the solar system at almost 500 kilometers per second. They are going to pass within half a billion kilometers of the Sun, a hairbreadth miss in cosmic terms. In the process, they will wreak havoc on the tidy layout of the solar system. Jupiter, dragged a few million kilometers sunward, will enter an unstable elliptical orbit, and over the course of a few thousand years, it will destabilize all the other planets. Luna departs first, catapulted out of the plane of the elliptic. Earth, most massive of all, will spend almost 5 million years wobbling between the former orbits of Venus and Saturn before it finally caroms past Jupiter and drifts off into the eternal night, the tattered remnants of its atmosphere condensing and freezing in a shroud of dry ice.